accession number 14620, Reel 2.
Major Smith, Reel 2. I was just about to ask you if the Sunderland Fire Service was an efficient one.
I think they're extremely efficient. Particularly early in the war, we were commanded by professional firemen from the old Sunderland Fire Brigade. And they were well qualified and experienced. They were, of course, supplemented by recruits for the war. And, of course, a lot of us were part-time. We did our normal daytime job. And we turned out when the sirens went, reported to our stations and were allocated to wherever we were needed. We did training sessions with our trailer fire pump pulled by an assortment of miscellaneous large horsepower cars and light trucks. It wasn't until later in the war that we were equipped with proper purpose-built vehicles for the fire brigade use.
Was there any rivalry between the regular firemen and the auxiliaries?
No, they were all integrated together. There was no way of that. The main fire station was the headquarters of the Auxiliary Fire Service and later the NFS in the area. And we had the peacetime, you know, red fire engines and everything. We as part-timers were often allowed to ride on the main engines. And if we happened to be on a training session and fire call came in for a normal peacetime fire, usually a chimney fire in that part of the world, we could sometimes ride with them. And in fact, I went out on a number of calls with them, with the fire brigade. Very exciting for a youngster, belting through the main street with bells going, you know, great. Hanging on the side of the truck. Mm.
Was there any hatred of the German pilots for carrying out the bombing?
I don't know, maybe. I never felt any hatred towards them. Not personally, obviously hated the Germans for destroying your life and your town and your familiar surroundings, for the damage they did. But it was impersonal. You couldn't sort of personalise it to the man in the plane.
How long were you in the Auxiliary Fire Service doing the job?
If you'd asked me that sooner, I could have dug up my records. From 19... From about March 1940, I came back from being evacuated until about 1943.
So several years.
Yes. Oh, yes.
Which was the worst time in Sunderland for the Brits?
I don't know. I can't remember offhand. I would think back into 42, early 43.
Quite late.
I would think so, yeah. I'd have to check my records on that. Then I got a scholarship to go to Sunderland Technical College to study engineering as part of my apprenticeship. I was a sandwich student, you know, part-time in the works, part-time at college. And in those days, you worked 6 months of the year and went to college the other 6 months of the year. You got paid for the 6 months you worked, but the 6 months you were at college, you didn't get paid for. But a generous government finally brought in that we could have dole, the students, and twice a week, at a special time arranged for students, we could go down to the Labour Exchange and sign on every Wednesday and Friday morning. And once a week, we collected 19 shillings as our dole while we were at college.
What was your actual job?
Apprentice marine engineer.
Whereabouts?
A firm called John Dickinson and Sons. Palmer's Hill Engine Works, Sunderland. It's now all and utterly destroyed and cleared. Not a vestige of the place left.
Was your work much affected by the war?
We had a few near misses. We had a ship sunk in the river just off our quay. A lot of the work we did was repairing war-damaged ships, which, from an apprentice point of view, was very good because we got a much wider experience dealing with ships of all nationalities. For example, we had Norwegian, Swedish ships, Dutch ships, which of course couldn't go back home because they were occupied by the Germans. So we had to make the parts. No drawings. They had to measure up the broken bits and make new ones. And our designers often had to design things from scratch to fit the foreign engines, which is good experience.
Was there ever such a thing as a strike or industrial action during the war?
Yes. As apprentices, well, first of all, when the war came, most of the able-bodied people disappeared into the services. All the sort of 21 to 50 people. So our works, which had been closed during the Depression and had been reactivated at the start of the war into full production again, was staffed largely with apprentices and old men, many of whom had come out of retirement to do their bit for the war effort. Now, these old boys were quite well qualified. Many of them were ex-ships chief engineers, ticketed engineers, good experience practically, and good engineers. And they trained we apprentices to do things. And, of course, being young and fit and strong compared with them, we often got the heavy jobs to do along with them. And very soon, as we became more senior apprentices, we were doing the jobs on our own. And this was at a time when we were receiving about £1.10, which is £1.50 today, for a 47-hour week. Now, many of these fully skilled workers, they were, of course, were on full wages plus war bonuses and whatever. But we as apprentices didn't get that. We were apprentices, you see. It was it was the thing in those days that you were being taught a trade, and any money you got was just a sort of a bonus, really. And many of us felt that this was not fair, that we were contributing considerably to the work of the firm. And this was not just in our place, this was generally in the whole of the Northeast. And the apprentices on the Tyne thought this was unfair, and they decided that they would campaign for a more equitable wage, more related to the work they were doing. And they started a campaign. In fact, we had a strike. The first ever strike by apprentices. I mean, it was unheard of. It's in your deeds of your articles of apprenticeship that you mustn't go on strike, you mustn't take part in trade disputes. So it was quite a thing. Eventually it was settled fairly quickly and we got a rise, and I think my wages doubled. I think I went up to about £2.10.
So there was a
token strike. It wasn't a really very long or...
Did it last hours or days or what?
Oh, it lasted about 3 days, I think, 3 or 4 days.
How did the people on the Tyne contact you to say that?
Oh, well, only 12 miles away or 7 miles away. We used to have... people used to travel. People from that... from South Shields used to work in Sunderland, and people from Sunderland work in South Shields, wherever. They were a pretty fairly close community, they weren't separated by very much.
Who told you that it was on?
Oh, I can't remember. Word went round. Probably the union, actually, come to think of it.
Was it organised through the union or outside the union?
Well, they certainly took a benevolent interest in this. The old Amalgamated Engineering Union.
What did the regular employees, the grown-up employees, think of it?
They generally supported us, as far as I can remember.
Well, did anybody say that it was disloyal because there was a war on?
No one ever said that. The main thrust against us was that as apprentices we were not allowed to strike, and we risked having our apprenticeship terminated.
Do you think it affected the war efforts much?
No.
Which year would it have taken place in, do you think?
About 43, I think, something like that.
But it seems to have had its desired effect in raising...
in raising our wages, yes. We got a more appropriate remuneration.
Was that the only strike or industrial action during the war that you remember?
Yeah. The only one I was involved in, anyway. As far as I was aware, there weren't any... there were a few sort of minor disputes. The sort of thing that would happen is that... in order to supplement the labour force, the Ministry of Labour introduced trainees. In other words, you'd take a chap and train him as, say, a welder for a fortnight and then send him to the shipyard to work as a welder. And he would be expected to work with welders who'd, been in the trade for years. And this didn't help labour relations very much. Particularly when they were getting the same wage as chaps who'd been welders for years and, done their training over the years. But these were sort of minor things. They weren't great significance. Local disputes that were usually ironed out fairly quickly.
Do you have any VE Day memory?
No. I seem to remember welcoming it as a holiday, I'm going off into the country on my bike. We never had any street parties or any nonsense like that.
Any VJ day memory?
No, none at all. I can't even remember it, actually.
Why do you think it, VE Day was so low key?
Because the war was still on. When was it anyway, VE Day?
May 45.
Yeah, I'd have to look up my old diaries if I've still got them. See, I really got no memories of it, actually. I seem to remember going off on my bike into the country. Welcome to day off, sort of thing. We had a holiday.
What about that famous election in 1945 when Labour got in with that big majority? Do you have any memories of that in Sunderland?
No, I wasn't a political animal in those days.
How did you come to be in the forces yourself?
Right, well, when I was at college, we had a contingent of the Durham University OTC, what was called the STC in those days, Senior Training Corps. I was separated from the Junior Training Corps, which a lot of schools had, you know, places like Eton College and Harrow, and they had JTCs, but universities had OTCs, STCs, right? Used to be the OTC. So, on a Wednesday afternoon and Saturdays, we used to train, military training. We were dressed in full military uniforms. We had a regular permanent staff instructor in the shape of a sergeant in the Durham Light Infantry. And we had our captain, who was a TA officer, First World War veteran, too old to take part in the current war, at our headquarters at King's College in Newcastle. We had a regular army adjutant who was a veteran of Dunkirk, a good soldier, being wounded and whatever, and we had further training people. And we used to have an annual camp, like the TA used to do, go off to camp for a fortnight and do exercises, training, whatever. All good value, quite exciting, quite realistic. Then the Home Guard was formed, and they made our OTC contingent into a company of the Home Guard. We were still the OTC, but we sort of a bleak stroke Home Guard after us, so that we were affiliated or were part of the Home Guard set up.
How old were you when you were doing this?
Somewhere between 17, 18, 19, coming up 20. Looking back, one wonders how you managed to do all this. Certainly, my studies suffered, because I failed my exams the first time. I had to retake them. I failed them the second time. I never did retake them, because they chucked me out. Anyway, how did I get into the army? I was finished my apprenticeship, and I became a junior draftsman in the same firm. I could see that as the war ended, the firm I was working for would probably decline again and not be in the forefront, because we'd been taken over by a group called Richardson Westgarth. They're still in existence, but not in the engineering field anymore. And obviously there was no promotion prospects where I was, so I used to look through the technical press, and I found an advert for a job with a firm called Hall Russell and Company up in Aberdeen, who used to build trawlers and such like. And I applied for a job and got it. Now, in those days, you had to apply to the Ministry of Labour for permission to change your job. So I duly sent a letter off saying I got this job in Aberdeen, may I have permission to change my job? And they wrote back saying, yes, you can go, but we wouldn't advise it, as you are shortly to be called up for service in HM Forces as a driver in the RAF. Oh, thanks very much, great. Anyway, a week or two later, my calling up notice appeared, and I duly reported to Newcastle, to the centre, and have a medical. And when you'd had your medical, you were then interviewed by the officers of the services, sort of preliminary interview to see which, you know, where to put you, sort of thing. Anyway, as I was down for the RAF, I was seen by an RAF officer, and I said to him, well, I don't want to join you a lot, I want to join the army. I want to go into REME. I'm an engineer, you know, complete my apprenticeship, I want to go into REME. So the RAF officer marched me along the corridor and wheeled me into the room where the army officer was interviewing and said, this chap wants to join you a lot, I can't think why, and left me with him. So he said, oh, you want to join the army, do you? I said, yeah, I want to join REME. So he shuffled through his papers and he said, well, there's no vacancies in the REME, but you've got a vacancy in Royal Engineers. So I hummed and hawed and thought, well, sure, all right, shove me down for that. Then in due course I was ordered to report to the primary training wing at Bransworth Castle, the DLI, and learning the basic, you know, how to march and drill and whatever.
This is 46, I think.
This is in 46. Yeah, we're back onto this list now, aren't we? Now, I'd been in the OTC and I'd got what's called Certificate A and Certificate B. Certificate A was a basic qualification, equivalent to a sort of trained soldier. Certificate B was supposed to be equivalent to a sort of second lieutenant training. You know, you were expected to know elementary tactics and to be capable in handling all the infantry weapons and whatever. So when I got to PTW, I knew it all, you know, I was a clever bugger, I knew it all. So they said, all right, you can take Private Bloggs away and teach him, because he's one of the awkward squad, you know, and give him private tuition. I was also sort of earmarked for commission, or commission worthy, or whatever they called it. So it was a good thing, this OTC training, and it helped me a lot. I'd been a sergeant in the OTC.
How did you come into bomb disposal work?
Well, when you finished primary training, I was earmarked for the Royal Engineers, so I was sent down here to Aldershot, to Malta Barracks down in Aldershot, and did basic sapper training. All the skills of a sapper basically has to know. Everything from sort of knots and lashings to dealing with clearing minefields and bridging and all the rest of it. And again, my card had been marked. I'd been on a WASB for officer selection, and I passed that, and in due course, when I completed my primary training, I went off to the Royal Engineer Octave at Newark. And on completion of my training at Newark, I was allocated to an ENMYO course. The idea was that with the war in Europe ending and the war in Japan still ongoing, that we would need to send forces out to the Far East. So all our training was getting geared towards the Far Eastern situation. And I was selected for what I suppose would be a works-based, works in the army terms means you know, barrack buildings and installations and this sort of thing, for a work stream rather than a field stream. So off I went on this E&M course to the School of Military Engineering at Ripon. And I did half of that course as an officer cadet, and then I was commissioned, and then the other half of the course as a second lieutenant. At the end of that course, we were posted. And would you believe, out of the, I think 12 of us, five of us were posted to bomb dispersal. Just like that. No choice, no option, there it was. Smith FC 7 Bomb Dispersal Squadron, Bristol. And that's how I came to bomb dispersal.
Did you then set about clearing up the remains of unexploded bombs in Bristol?
No, what then happened was, I went off down to Bristol, all bright-eyed, bushy-tailed with a shiny new pip, and met my OC, who said, I don't want an E&M chap, I've got one. You'll have to go and be a normal troop officer and work on bomb dispersal operations. So I was put under the wing of two more experienced lieutenants, and off we went to learn how to deal with bombs. And my first bomb was down in near Avonmouth in Bristol.
Can you remember what you did?
I watched them.
How did they do it?
Oh, I learnt very carefully how they did it and watched them very carefully. I got a photograph of it as well, actually. No, it was training. You watched what went on, and you learnt, and you saw how it was done. And then a week or two after that, they sent me on a course to learn how to do it properly.
Where was the bomb in Avonmouth? In the docks?
No. It was at a place called Hallen, near Bristol. It was a 250-kilo SC, which is a thin-walled bomb, with a 15 fuse. It was one of the abandoned bombs that we were talking about earlier. There were loads of them in Bristol.
Did they have any complications with that one?
No, straightforward, impact fused, no problem.
When did you go out yourself to do it?
Oh, a month or two later.
In
the Bristol area. I was given my share of jobs to do and put in charge of working parties. In those days, we had they were German prisoners of war who had volunteered for work on bomb disposal and on beach mine clearance. And for this, they received an extra threepence a day.